This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North. We are at the Pabst Milwaukee Brewery and Tap Room in front of a live audience as part of our on-site series. We are going to explore tonight Milwaukee's brewery district, the beverage that made Milwaukee famous, and the buildings and people which made that beverage. We're going to take a, well, John said not quite a deep dive, because we don't have quite that much time, but a shallow dive into the history of the area, when the brewery came here, what was here before that, and how we got to where we are today. We are going to start with the history. And when you talk about Milwaukee history, there is only one person that comes to mind, and we are so pleased to have him on Lake Effect On-Site tonight. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to historian John Gerda. And of course, the other piece of this first segment is how this complex has evolved since redevelopment began. And there was only one person who came to mind for that conversation, and it's the former architecture critic for the Journal Sentinel, Whitney Gould. Welcome to Whitney. Thank you both for being here tonight, and what a great room. This is such a great place to have this show. And so, John, I'm going to start with you. Pabst Blue Ribbon, or PBR, is known as the beer that made Milwaukee famous.
That'd be Schlitz. Pabst's slogan was, Milwaukee beer is famous, Pabst has made it so. And Schlitz was the beer that made Milwaukee famous.
Okay.
So close to each other.
Close to each other. So which was here first?
Certainly Pabst. They go back to 1844. Schlitz is 1850. And where they began was about two blocks east of here on 9th and Juneau. And it was the father, Jacob Best Sr., and his four sons who came over from the Rhineland. And they came over, the first two sons, in 1842, and the whole family came over in 1844. And for context, the city of Milwaukee was incorporated back in 1846. So they were here 2 years before Milwaukee became a city.
So breweries were here first.
They were here first, yep.
Okay.
There are a lot of things here first, but the city incorporated back in 1846. And they located here on what they called the Chestnut Street Hill, and now it's Juneau Avenue. And all that was here in those early years was trees. This was heavily wooded. And you go north and west, all that happened later on for a number of years was farmland. So this was pretty much the edge of town when they located here. And early on, their first product was vinegar. So that was a little kind of off pattern for what they became. And you had so many Germans here. And this was, by 1850, this was about a two-thirds foreign-born city. And by far the largest group here was Germans. So you had a prodigious thirst and people who knew how to satisfy it. And the Pabsts, the Bests rather, were among about two dozen breweries in Milwaukee before the Civil War. And then what happened, the transition, was a lake captain named Captain Frederick Pabst married one of Philip Best's daughters, and pretty soon he was running the place.
When did that happen?
1860-something was when he married in, and he became kind of the guiding light of the entire brewery. 1889, after his brother-in-law had died, he named the brewery for himself, although he had been pretty much kind of the de facto head of it for a long time before then. And if you look on the trademark of Pabst today, there is a B in the circle of these hops, the hops there, and that stands for Best. So the family is remembered.
So in the heyday of the brewery here, the first, you know, Best and then Pabst, what did this area, I mean, was it busy like it is now?
After the farmlands were kind of converted, this became very much a German neighborhood. You would have needed to speak German in this neighborhood to kind of get by. Institutions, other small breweries, you know, Schlitz is only a few blocks east of here and just a little bit north, all kinds of factories. This is pre-zoning. There was no zoning until 1920. So it was like taking land uses in a dice cup and just rolling them across the landscape. It was just really a mess, really a hodgepodge. A good example of that is this building. This was the old Forest Cellar restaurant. It began as a church. This was built back in 1872 as the first German Methodist church, which was one of the most poor siting decisions in Milwaukee's history. This is a Methodist church that really railed against what they call the evil of drunkenness. So here they are, they're next door to the Malt House, the Best Brewery. And on a summer Sunday, they'd have the windows open, no air conditioning back in those years, and the smell of brewing beer would just pour through these windows. The sacred and the profane kind of in one package. So they kind of, they soldiered on for a while. Then I think 1895 is the captain put them out of their misery, bought the church for $25,000, and they moved a mile west here, sort of beyond the range of the sights
and the
smells.
I was surprised to hear that it was a Methodist church, because I'm thinking of most of the Germans were Lutheran.
They were a mix. They were Catholic, Lutheran, Jewish, Reformed, Methodist. They were all over the lot.
Everybody.
I've always said that the most important thing the Germans had in common was that they had nothing in common.
Except this, the beer.
Except the beer. But even there were teetotalers even there. There were people who kind of were against the amber nectar.
So how many people were working in the breweries at that time?
Certainly hundreds. I don't have an exact figure, Bonnie. But it was only one year back in 1890 was beer our most important product. And by then, there would have certainly been some thousands of workers in the brewing industry. And they had a unique fringe benefit, which, of course, was free beer. And that was something they could drink on the job. There was one newspaper account from back in the 1880s. It was the brewmaster at Schlitz who said the champion worker downed something like 120 short glasses of beer in his shift, in small glasses. I figured it out. It's a case and a half of beer.
In a shift?
In one shift. I mean, the shifts are 12 hours, but still.
Still, that's a lot.
That's an awful lot of beer. The big change here was that early on, the brewers, Best, Pabst, and all the others, they were pretty much satisfying a local thirst. The ones who were really ambitious and talented, and the ones who had kind of this vision of something larger, and that would have included the ones you know today, Schlitz, Blatz, Pabst, and Miller, you know, those four especially. They began to kind of outstrip the capacity of the local market, so they became what they call shipping brewers, so they export their beer all around the country. And what really helped that was the Chicago fire back in 1871 that destroyed about half their breweries, and Milwaukee was only too glad to kind of fill in that vacuum. So by 1868, Pabst is the largest brewery in Milwaukee. By 1874, Pabst Best is the largest brewery in America. 30 years, 1844 to 1874, they go from zero to number one in the entire country. So this really was a great enterprise.
It's an amazing shift to go that big, that fast. And I have to say, I didn't realize that they were just producing locally for that long.
And early on, it was transportation. You know, you could put kegs on a boat and send them down to Chicago, but trains really helped that, certainly helped them reach a much larger market. And in time, Pabst was selling out in the Sandwich Islands, Hawaii, so they really did go far, far afield.
Wow. Water, of course, plays such an important part of beer. And
sure.
Was there something about the water here, or was it just a good place and happened to be a lot of Germans here?
It was a good place to grow barley. It was a good place to grow hop before it went out to the northwest coast or Germany. Germany a long, long time before. Certainly good farmland helped. A hidden advantage here was the fact that before you had mechanical refrigeration, they would keep their beer cool during the winter, selling season by ice, no natural refrigeration. So the fact that Milwaukee had true winters enabled them to have this sustainable harvest of ice, freeze cut, freeze cut, freeze cut. And places like Cincinnati and St. Louis, the other corners of the German triangle, they had breweries as well because they had a lot of Germans, but it got really hot in the summertime. So they were at a disadvantage. They'd often run out of ice before the season was over. So the fact that Milwaukee had true winters, it's a little early for us right now. But that was certainly an advantage. But it was not the character of the water so much. It would have been well water here before they began to use lake water. But it was, those things were certainly important, but it was Germans.
It was the
deciding factor.
So why did Pabst close up here?
They went through a long, long period of, like all the breweries, Prohibition, 1919 to 1933. And that certainly slowed things down. World War II, I think they went 450,000 barrels a year or so to the armed forces. They introduced a camouflage beer can, which is one of their innovations. And they were doing really well. They were always in the top three, and the top three were Anheuser-Busch and St. Louis, Schlitz and Pabst. And by the years after World War II, they were kind of came up to number one again. And then what happened is kind of this long, slow slide, managerial issues. They failed to keep up with the advertising revenues. And they sort of got bypassed. The Pabst were long gone by then. Control shifted back in 1932. They were sold to a Peoria company. And that happened certainly at a time when they were vulnerable, and they became more so over time. So they were in 1985 purchased by a California investor named Paul Kalmanovitz, who cut back capital spending, and he erased the advertising budget. He didn't just cut it, he erased it. So what they were doing was running on fumes. And not surprisingly, this brewery closed in 1996. And so he kind of ran into the ground. And it was, Whitney recalls this as well. It was a ruin. Graffiti, on all the buildings, many of the buildings, collapsing brick walls, trees, good-sized trees growing out of the roofs, so it was really in terrible shape. And I recall being concerned for the future of this really very substantial part of Milwaukee's downtown's northwest side. So to see it come back is just, it's wonderful.
Well, it is a perfect time to bring Whitney into the conversation. And so, you and I talked before we sat down tonight and to talk about the transformation that has happened here. So what was it about the buildings and the complex here that make them architecturally significant and worth saving?
I think all of you have probably figured that out for yourselves. A lot of these buildings that remain are really beautiful artifacts, mostly Gothic Revival, Romanesque Revival, Cream City brick buildings with a little bit of Chicago pink brick thrown in, mostly built between about 1877 and 1930. And when, if you remember the old brewery, even in its heyday, it was like coming into a sort of medieval walled city here. It had a character all its own that you don't find in a lot of new developments. So I think there was a lot of sentiment in favor of saving all or part of this complex, but no one quite knew how to do it. And after the brewery closed in 1996, a few years later, there was a proposal by two developers, including a subsidiary of We Energies, to redevelop it. They had a very ambitious $350 million plan to put in retail, residential, businesses, restaurants. It was a huge plan, very innovative in many ways. They were even going to put in a movie theater. Well, it never got off the ground. The Common Council never approved the plans. It involved a lot of demolition. And to make a long story short, then the now late developer, Joe Zilber, and his company eventually bought the entire site, and he was able to do what the previous developers couldn't. And he sort of farmed out individual redevelopment projects to different developers. And the city passed in 2006 what they call a development incentive zone that would provide about $29 million worth of tax incremental financing to help pay for improvements in streets and sewers and lighting and sidewalks and everything. And they wanted to put in a sustainable development that would use a lot of recycled materials, preserve what as much as could be preserved of the old stuff, and to create a really walkable, tight-knit little community for housing, hotels, entertainment. And that's what you really see today. And to me, it is one of the most remarkable transformations.
The word you used to me was dandy. It was a dandy example of how preserving an area can be done while incorporating the new. So I'm hoping you can give us some examples of how that was done and why those two things juxtapose so well together.
It's a really interesting trend. For years in the preservation community, there was the feeling that when you built new buildings in old neighborhoods, that they really sort of had to look like everything that was here before. And the problem with that approach is that nothing is ever going to be as good as the old stuff. We don't have the money or the artisans to do it. And so what we end up is a lot of dumbed down, sort of cheapened, faux old buildings. And it's just one of my pet peeves, it drives me crazy. But anyway, this development here is an example of how you can marry good contemporary architecture to historic preservation and really have a sense of speaking to history. And I think if I, as a contrarian, if I had my way, the new stuff would have been even more adventurous than what came in, but it's still very well done. The new buildings are sensitive in scale and proportions to what's here. They even pick up on some of the colors of the Cream City brick, but they use a lot of modern materials, glass and steel and metal. So you have a sense as you walk through here of a real dialogue between past and present, and you have a sense of a really lively community. It's not a museum, and it's also not a place that was leveled just to put in new development. So I think it sort of shows the example of creative historic preservation combined with good planning. Our city planners, I want to give a nod to, I'm on the City Plan Commission, so I've got a little bias there. But they are really great, dedicated people who have a passion for this city. And they were very patient. Joe Zilber was patient, and they wanted to do it right. And they also put in a lot of little green spaces, not only because they are a beautiful little touch with native plantings, but also because they capture stormwater and prevent it from running into our overloaded sewer system. So it's an example. It may not be perfect, but it's such a wonderful, vibrant example of, again, how you can put together the old and the new and create something quite wonderful.
You agree, John?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. This was a dead zone. This was Sargasso Sea on the northwest side of downtown, and now it's just brimming with life.
Yeah. Well, Whitney and John, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. It has been such a pleasure having you on the show. John Goerda is the author of several books about Milwaukee's history, including The Making of Milwaukee and Milwaukee City of Neighborhoods. And Whitney Gould was the longtime architecture critic for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's currently a member of the city's Plan Commission and the Design Review Team.
Thank you, guys.